The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in this morning for quite an interesting show, as you will see unfold in just a few minutes. Also note that we're using the one-hour format show today, not the 90 minutes. So if you do have emails or comments or want to call and talk to our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, please note that it ends at 1 hour. So don't wait until the last minute to get your question or comments in or to use the phone call. And for those of you who do want to call us, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And for those of you using email today, it is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So please do check it out. So we have a very detailed newsletter there in the middle of the page that's uploaded fresh each week after the Sunday program. So it has all of the details of the week's programs, guest bios, and the future events for what's coming on board the Space Show. And then if we change our schedule, this is where we do it. And sometimes that does happen, so we do sometimes change our schedule. And then all of our programs are archived on our website. You can easily download the shows or listen right off of our website, and you will see all that there. You can do the same thing on our blog, thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And there you can also exchange notes with other guests about the shows, and sometimes with the guests themselves will enter into a conversation with you, but for sure many listeners will. So use that feature on the blog. And then in addition, on the Space Show, there is a store up at the top. You'll see it, Space Show Gear, and you'll hopefully find some items of interest. To me, the most important button is the Support the Space Show. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with one, giantleapfoundation.org. And we're able to bring you these programs free of charge because many of you do support and contribute to the Space Show. So remember, if you do so and you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true for those of you paying California taxes, as we're a California public benefit corporation. You'll also see a guest search tool there, and that is a chronological listing of all of our shows since 2001. And I might add, today is our 14th birthday of doing the Space Show, and we're rapidly approaching 2,500 programs. But guest search will let you do a global search for your keywords like sun, Mars, tourism, X-Core, whatever your fancy search term may be. And all of the programs we've had where that has been a substantial part of the discussion will show up by date. Jot those dates down, and then you can pick them up on our Space Show search engine at the bottom of our homepage as it searches chronologically. When we design our new website, that database will be interactive, and you won't have to go through all these steps anymore, but we're still working toward that. We podcast, and you can pick up our RSL for podcasting on our website, as well as on the two newsletters, the very short email newsletter that goes out Monday morning, as well as the website newsletter. So if you have any questions about podcasting, do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then I also just want to remind everybody that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they do a lot of different things to promote cooperative solutions for space security. And if you go to their website, which is swfound.org, you can get a lot more information about this organization, read their white papers, probably see many of their video conferences and things like that. They also sponsor our webinar series. A good organization to be associated with, Secure World Foundation, or swfound.org. And that brings me to our program today. So I'm very happy to bring back to the show Dr. Paul Brekke, and he is in Norway, but he's actually in the United States right now. He received his Doctor of Science degree in 1993 from the Institute of Theoretical Astrophysics at the University of Oslo, with a focus on ultraviolet UV emissions from the sun, observed with instruments on sounding rockets and the space shuttle Challenger. His work focused on dynamic aspects of the sun and measuring variations in solar UV radiation. He has been involved in solar research, all sorts of things, including working with ESA, with NASA Goddard Space Center, and more. His full bio is on the website, and since we're on the 60-minute format show, and rather than reading all of it, I'd rather be talking to him, but I also want to call to your attention that he has done some incredible work on the Northern Lights, and he has a spectacular video DVD available, and I'm going to put the links to this in the archive of the show so that you can check out the DVD, which is at www.solarmax.no/aurora/dvd.html. And again, I'll put all of this information in the archives when I archive this program. We're going to talk about the sun today and the Northern Lights. So, Dr. Brekke, welcome back to the Space Show, and congratulations on your daughter's graduation. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you for being on the show again.
Tell us a little bit about the Northern Lights, and when you sent out some runners a couple of months ago on the DVD, I said, God, we gotta do another show with you about this. That was pretty phenomenal. So give us sort of the introduction to this.
Well, the Northern Light has been fascinating people for thousands of years. It's been one of the most, nature's most wonderful light shows, and it's all embedded in myths and superstition from old times, and it's actually just about 100 years ago we understood what it actually was. And today, the Northern Light tourism is blooming all over the world, and particularly in North Norway, where people coming from all over the world to see the Northern Lights. So that's why we decided to try to make the complete documentary, or tell the whole story about the Northern Lights from myths to modern science, and where to go, how to forecast it, and also how to take your own picture, which is not that difficult. So we tried to put this all into one documentary, and I think we quite succeeded here, according to people that have seen it now. They think this is a very nice way of presenting the story, but also presenting maybe some of the more difficult things to understand into easy access, and by using new graphics and new animation, we've tried to explain these physical mechanisms in an easy way.
What are some of the myths that surround the Northern Lights?
Well, most of the time in the ancient times, the Northern Lights was connected to something bad, or a war, or a disease going to break out. And in particularly when the Northern Lights moved further south, I mean, when there was really strong storms on the sun, then Northern Lights also moved further south into Europe, for instance. And then a few times they saw this, very often in the reddish part of Northern Lights, they were very scared. And so it usually was connected to something bad. And it's also connected to dead spirits, and there's also even some stories from USA, the Mandan Indian, they in North Dakota, then they saw this reddish hue on the sky in the north. They thought it was the reflections of the fires and the big pots where the great medicine man of the far north was boiling their enemies. So there's all kind of funny stories too into this.
What causes it to move further south?
Well, that's basically the way the Earth's magnetosphere is working, in connection with the sun. So the Earth has a magnetic like a bar magnet inside it, so that the Earth's magnetic field comes out of the polar region and goes around the Earth and enters into the other part of the pole, or the South Pole. And when the solar wind, a gust in the solar wind, is pushing on this magnetosphere, some particle will be channeled along these magnetic field lines down toward the polar regions. That's causing the northern light we will see every single day around the ring around the magnetic pole. And this is called the aurora oval. So if you are going far north and close to the circle, you will see the northern lights every single clear night. But when you have a wind gust or strong solar storms, which are then pushing much harder on the Earth's magnetosphere, this oval or this band where the northern light usually occurs will be much wider, and it moves further south. So the particle manages to penetrate further south. And that's when we can see the northern lights in the northern states of the United States and even the mid-states and sometimes even down to Florida. There's been seen northern lights in the last 10, 15 years.
You already have an email from Christine, and she is in Florida, and she said, what happens in the southern hemisphere? Is there an equivalent?
Yes, that's true. It's actually almost like a mirror picture of the northern lights or the southern lights in the southern hemisphere. It's actually called polar lights, and we usually call it northern lights because we are most used to see them up here north. But there's a similar light down there, and that was not discovered that early because it's very few people that's been to the Antarctic. You have to actually get inside the ice shelf to normally see the northern lights down there, or southern lights, sorry. It's only when there's really strong solar storms that the northern lights will then move further north, and then you can see it sometimes from the southern parts of Australia and New Zealand and so on.
Several months ago, one of my son's friends, whose father has a very successful business, flew some of his son's best friends to Alaska to a cabin out someplace outside of Fairbanks to watch the Northern Lights for his birthday present, some birthday present, right? And so, you know, my son went there with his camera and all of that, and he had never seen them before, and it was very clear outside of Fairbanks, and they were really treated to a show for a week straight, and it was quite amazing. He had heard of the Northern Lights and studied them in school, but seeing them was something that he had not expected. You know, it's very, very different than what he thought it would be. So I guess it's quite a show, which is why the tourism is such a big industry for this.
That's true, and that's you actually have to see it yourself. As an old explorer from Austria who a long time ago wrote one time that you can, the Northern Lights, you cannot describe it with any pencil, you cannot draw it with any brush and stuff like that. You have to experience it in real life. And it's much more spectacular to see it live than see it on any YouTube video or pictures. It's really amazing. It's every time you see the Northern Light, it will be different from the last time you saw it. It's the patterns, everything changing. It's also fascinating to think that it's actually the sun that is pushing on our magnetosphere that creates these flickering movements in the Northern Lights. You can think of it like a flag waving in the wind. Here we see the Earth's atmosphere, the magnetic field, and Northern Lights actually waving in the wind just like a flag due to the solar wind.
But what causes it to have different colors? Like sometimes they're a really gorgeous shade of green, for example. What causes the color change?
The color changes are basically depending on how quickly the particles move down to the atmosphere. The mechanism is exactly the same as you have in a neon tube or like a commercial sign outside the restaurant or something. So by putting different gases into this tube, you can get different colors in your commercial sign. And what happens when you turn on the power on the neon tube is that electrons fly through this gas, and it will then, you may say, irritate. We call it excite every single atom in that gas. So one of the electrons around the atom will move a little bit further out, away from the atom, and drops down again because it's not, doesn't like to be excited. And it sends out a color depending on the distance between those two electron orbits.
Now,
by putting different gases in there, you can select a color. And the same thing happened in the atmosphere of the Earth, that the particles will then collide with different atoms and molecules, and that will create different colors. And if you have faster particles, for instance, then you will be able to excite different atoms than the slow particles, and that will give you a shade of different colors.
There are other places in the solar system with a magnetosphere. Does any place that has a magnetosphere have the equivalent of Northern Lights?
That's right. So all the planets in the solar system which has an atmosphere and a magnetic field will also experience polar lights. So there's some great pictures online from Hubble showing the Northern Lights over Jupiter and Saturn in particular, but also the Neptune and Uranus have also seen it. And there's even some really nice sequences taken from the Cassini mission orbiting Saturn, where you can see the same kind of oval that you have around the Earth.
You have an email from Bijan, who is in Sweden, and he says, the Sun could be used as a gravitational lens by a telescope launched to at least 5 times further away than where Voyager is today. Is this correct? Are there any heliophysical problems with the solar gravitational lens concept? Would the corona distort that lensing beyond usefulness?
That's a difficult question to answer,
right,
actually. But the Sun can, in principle, be used as a gravitational lensing object. It's been used by looking at the distance to stars, when the stars moving close to the Sun and disappearing around the edge. The light from that star will be bent a little bit. But when we're talking about gravitational lensing today, we're usually talking about how other galaxies far out in the universe are bending the light from objects either further away out in the universe, a quasar and so on. So the light will be bent by strong magnetic fields or gravitations, and that can be used to actually get information about the object behind something far away. But I'm not sure that's been so much useful for our understanding of the universe today to use the Sun in this way, as far as I know.
Are the Northern Lights influenced by sunspot activity?
Yes, absolutely. It's not really the sunspot activity, it's the Sun's general activity level that determines this. There's basically two things that are causing strong Northern Lights. And that's large eruptions of the Sun that can be basically big loops on the Sun that sometimes snap and be thrown out in space. When they hit the Earth's magnetic field, we get very strong Northern Lights. And when the Sun is very active, when there's more sunspot, it's usually more of these coronal mass ejections. So we get more sunspots, or more Northern Lights when the Sun is very active. So in principle, the Northern Lights also have an 11-year cycle, just like the Sun. But it's more to that than that. There's another feature on the Sun that's also creating the strong Northern Lights, and they are called coronal holes. It's basically, if you look at the Sun from space in a part of the spectrum, so you can only see the Sun's corona, you will see some dark, huge features sometimes, which is called coronal holes. And these are features on the Sun where the solar wind will easier escape the Sun, so it comes out with twice the speed as the rest of the Sun sends out the solar wind. So instead of having a velocity of 1.5 million kilometers, the solar wind from coronal holes has about 3 million kilometers per hour. And that means when the Sun rotates and the coronal hole comes into the center of the Sun, it will then spray out faster solar wind, and 2-3 days later we will get that wind gust in the face, so to speak. So that coronal hole will create a large disturbance in our magnetosphere, the geomagnetic storm. That will also create very strong Northern Lights. So if you're really looking at the distribution of the Northern Lights and the sunspot cycle, you will see that the Northern Light distribution actually peaks 1 to 2 years after the solar maximum. And we are actually right there now. There's 2 years since the solar maximum, and this year and the next 1 or 2 years will be really good. And the reason for this displacement is that coronal holes are much more, occur more often just after the solar maximum.
Pretty fascinating. Here you have another email from Clara, who's in Las Vegas. And Clara says, I get email newsletters from time to time that talk about space weather or solar weather. I don't really understand this because weather seems to me to be what we have here on Earth. Is it going to rain? Are there winds? Are there big storms? But there is no rain or things like that in space. So what is really meant by solar or space weather?
That's a very good question, actually. And it's something we just started to call space weather is basically the disturbances that the sun producing in our near-Earth environment. So when something happens to the sun, a few days later, or also the light a few minutes later, will then disturb our atmosphere or disturb our magnetosphere. And that will cause problems for many of our technology-based systems like satellites, power grids, navigation systems, and so on, radio communication. And that's why we're starting using the notation space weather, because it actually has an effect for us down on ground, even if it's not the weather in the same way we talk about weather daily. But it's a nice way of doing it because it's very many similarities with space weather, because just like a storm will affect power grids and can cause flooding and so on, space weather can also cause problems with our systems that we are depending on every day. So it's in many ways useful to use that notation, and also NOAA that also providing space weather warnings, just like making weather forecasts, they also have the same kind of scales for the severity of the different types of storms from the sun and how much they will affect our systems.
Does space weather or the solar activity impact our climate in any big way on Earth?
Not the space weather itself, but as long as the sun is our main energy source, and if the amount of energy from the sun changes, that will also change the energy input to the Earth, the system. So if you're changing the sun's output, that can, of course, over long term, also change the climate. And in addition, the sun also sends out ultraviolet radiation, which can change the chemical contents in the atmosphere. It will change, for instance, the amount of ozone, which is a climate has a climate effect. In addition, there's also particles from the universe called cosmic rays, which are controlled by the sun, how many of them will reach Earth. And some scientists claim that these can also maybe change clouds someplace on the Earth. So there's many indications that the sun has also an effect on the climate. And if you're looking back in history, you can see that the solar activity very often are in good sync with the climate on the Earth. So this is a very interesting topic to study, and lots of scientists are studying it. And there's, of course, a big discussion scientifically, how big is this effect? And there's also other natural effects on the climate. There's internal effects on the Earth's climate. Then you have the human-caused climate change effects like CO2, certain aerosols, and land use changes. So there's many different forcings on the climate, and many of them we don't understand fully yet.
You're getting some really interesting questions. Here's one from Jack. I would have never thought of this. Jack is in Chicago. He says, David, I'm at work, so I can't call in. He says, I know we have solar satellites like SOHO pretty far out there from Earth looking at the sun, but the sun is billions of degrees in temperature. So here's my question. Given that space is really, really cold, how close can a satellite get to the sun before the sun's temperatures would actually interact and destroy the satellite? It seems to me that you could get pretty close given that space itself is so cold.
Yeah, that's actually correct. It's, even if the solar corona is at a temperature of about 2 million degrees, and that's stretching out quite far away from the sun, the density of the corona is really low. So there's very few atoms that are moving fast. So even if it's 2 million degrees, you can almost stick your hand in there, and you don't want to burn yourself because there's very few atoms there.
You could stick your hand in the corona?
Not all the way into the corona, but you can get pretty close because of the very low density. I mean, if you only have 1-2 atoms per square meter or something, even if that temperature in that box was 2 million degrees, those two atoms wouldn't really burn your hand because they wouldn't hit it. But it will be harder when you get closer, of course. Just like if fuel on Mercury or something, it's much hotter than the Earth. And NASA is now also building a spacecraft called Solar Probe, which it will actually send into the sun and get closer and closer to get better and better pictures, more high resolution. That's a big challenge, of course, because when you get close to the sun, all the systems will be very hot, so you need to make these in materials or shield them so they don't get overheated before the electronic doesn't work anymore. So it's a big challenge, but we can get quite close. And Europe is actually building a mission called Solar Orbiter, which will go into orbit much closer than Mercury even, to also get very close, because we haven't really been close to the sun yet.
What is defined by close to the sun? I mean, at some point, wouldn't you start to get gobbled up by their gravity?
Yeah, certainly you will. At some point fall into the sun if you get too close. That's for sure.
Is there a magic number of kilometers that you can get to?
I don't have that on top of my head, but it's. I think if you go into NASA's webpage and searching on Solar Probe, you can read more about how they think that mission will work and how close it will get before there's nothing left of the probe yet. But it's a very interesting mission, trying to get really close to the sun and see what's really there, because we still have a limit of how big telescopes we can put up in space, and again, that will limit how fine detailed picture can we make of the solar surface. And what happened every time we make a new mission, there's a new mission called IRIS, made by Lockheed and NASA, which now give the best pictures of the sun in many ways. But every time you get higher resolution, you see more details, and it just opens up new questions. I think that will still be the case. If you get really close, you will just see more fine structure, and that will even, you have to scratch your head even more.
Bijan in Sweden sent in another comment, and he says, could a sudden sun activity melt our microelectronics, or would another Carrington event just temporarily make the lights go out?
Yeah, well, the Carrington event is, you know, this is a famous storm that happens in 1859. It was so strong that Carrington saw a flash with his naked eye, and it 17 hours later, you know, the power of the grids and the telegraph system was disrupted all over Europe and the United States, and it was so much power induced in the telegraph system that the lines was actually glowing in the dark. It was so much power. And the northern light was pushed all the way down to the equator. So the big question today is, what will happen if we get a similar storm today when we have lots of satellites up in space and lots of power grids? And that's been a big concern, and there's a very interesting report from the National Academy of Sciences that brings up this. And they conclude that in the United States, one may lose power for many years in many regions because it takes time to build up transforms and so on. And so this could be a serious problem for our society in many ways. But it wouldn't fry up things on the ground. It's basically space-based systems that will be disrupted and the power grids on the Earth. And in 2012, there's a question now, how often do these superstorms happen? And we only have seen one. But in 2012, the STEREO mission, the two identical satellites, are on the far side of the sun, and they observed a solar storm from the far side of the sun that was probably as strong as the Carrington event, but it was going away from the Earth, luckily. So if it happened 9 days earlier, we would probably have been tested to see how our systems will be reacting to a superstorm.
Do they build the electronics for space to withstand a superstorm, or do they roll the dice?
I think they build it to withstand a superstorm because they have never experienced a superstorm in modern times, so you don't know what that will do. But satellites in general are built with what we call space-qualified systems. Like, take the Hubble, for instance. When Hubble was launched in 1990, it had a 286 processor, for those who are old enough to know how slow a processor that is.
Uh-huh.
And 6 years later, or maybe 8 years later, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was the second servicing mission, they replaced that CPU with a 486. It takes several years before you can space qualify a computer CPU because you need to know it works. There's lots of radiation there that can destroy it. So space missions have usually electronics that are lagging 10 years in what we're using in our cell phones or whatever. So things need to be space qualified, need to be tested, and they put it into a vacuum chamber. They bombard it with particles, they bake it, and they cold it down so they know it works. So that's why it's expensive, of course, but it also takes time to build a spacecraft. And when a spacecraft is gone and ready to launch, it's usually 5 to 10 years old electronics in there. And if, in addition, the mission going to Saturn takes maybe 7 years to get there, you can imagine that's a fairly old electronics. And but Hubble still works with that 486 processor, and it doesn't run Windows, so it doesn't have to have that really power. Actually, it's an assembled code.
Is this something people should lose sleep over, or is it so rare that it's not worth losing sleep over, that we could be without power for ages as a result of a solar storm, a massive solar storm?
I don't think people should be afraid of this. I think the power system they have learned a lesson from the Quebec event in 89, when they lost power in Quebec. And they're doing their measure. They can do a lot of things when they're observing a storm. They can reduce the load of the system. They can maybe shut down some industry and so on to minimizing the effect of these things. And so for us people, it shouldn't be any big problems, I think. And if they can minimize this to be maybe a power outage for a day or two, then it's no problem at all.
And the detection is, they can always detect these storms. It's not like you don't find a NEO until it's right on top of you, because maybe it's so small or something like that. The storms are detectable, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's several things that happen on the sun when there's a solar storm. You have basically three or four different effects. First, you have this explosion. People have maybe heard about flares. That's a very intense X-ray emission increase, which are detected by satellites. And when the satellite goes going around the Earth, detecting this suddenly increase in X-rays and ultraviolet, we already hit. It's just like you're standing out on a field and you're hit by a lightning. It's too late. So then our atmosphere will be bombarded, and radio communication and some satellite navigation system will be disturbed. It's not critical for everybody, but if you're doing very critical navigation systems, for you will be in trouble for some time. In addition, you have this coronal mass ejection that comes out of the sun. That we can see coming out of the sun, and we could estimate the velocity and the arrival time typically 1 to 3 days later. This is the same as you using satellites and see a hurricane building up in the Atlantic. You can estimate when and where it will hit the coast. That's what the weather service is doing. And we do exactly the same with solar storms. We give an estimate, it will arrive, for instance, Sunday at noon, plus minus 3-4 hours. That's what they're doing. So then the users of satellites or operators of satellites and power grids can do their precaution from this storm. In addition, sometimes there's a particle event from the sun, high-energy particles, which can destroy satellites and harm people in space. So these are the three, basically, elements of solar storms, which have very different effects on our system and also have a very different arrival time to the Earth.
When you say arrival to the Earth, does that mean the entire Earth, or would it be the Northern Hemisphere or Europe or North America? Can it be that pinpointed and targeted, or is it the entire planet?
It's also a good question. It's when it comes to the ultraviolet X-ray radiation that bombards the Earth, that will basically be the sunlit side. So it will be where it's daytime, where we have problems with GPS and the radio communication. And very often the radio communication is more severely up in the Northern Hemisphere. When it comes to the CME, when that hits the Earth's magnetic field, it will disturb it and it will get what we call a geomagnetic storm. And that will basically be effective in the Northern Hemisphere, in the polar regions. Usually the same regions where you have the Northern Lights, which will then expand further south when there's a very strong storm, and on the same on the Southern Hemisphere. So that's a little bit more localized to where you have the Northern Lights in principle. When it comes to the proton shower, that will bombard the sunlit side again, and the night side also, actually, depending on, because it's lasting almost a day. But that's mostly severe for satellites and people on a space station, even if they are fairly well protected by the magnetosphere, this will be a more problematic issue when we go into the Moon or to Mars again, because then we are out in deep space with no protection at all.
Do people feel any of this on the Earth? Can you feel the results of a CME or anything like that?
On your body, you won't feel anything. The only thing you will see are the Northern Lights, and sometimes there might be problems with power grids. Of course, when you're losing power, you cannot charge your cell phone anymore, things like this. Or internet goes down, maybe even worse, when you cannot get on Facebook for a few hours.
Or Twitter, right? You can't.
Yeah, exactly. So for most people, this will not be a problem at all. It will be the systems that you're depending on sometimes that could be working less than or not as accurate as you want. For the airlines, you know, the polar flights usually are disturbed. And yet they're losing communication over the poles, and that's something they don't like, so they have to reroute the planes. So you might have a delayed flight due to this. So it's more like in that range people feel it on the body.
Jerry is in Tucson, Arizona, and he says, I'm fortunate. I've seen the Northern Lights a few times, but I have a very hard time taking pictures of them. My pictures really are bad. Is there a trick for taking pictures of the Northern Lights?
Yeah, actually, we're trying to describe that very well in our documentary. It's a few tricks you can do, and first of all, you need to have a camera which can be put in manual mode. So an iPhone or something doesn't work. The best is to use one of those DSLR cameras, the standard cameras where you can exchange lenses and so on.
Uh-huh.
And you need to put in manual mode because you usually need long exposure times, typically 5 to 10 to 20, 30 seconds, depending on how strong the Northern Lights is. And then to do that, you need a tripod. So the two most important thing: bring a tripod, have a camera that you can put in manual mode. And also, of course, you need to get out of the city light, because if you are in the city, you won't probably see the Northern Lights because there's so much glare from the street lights up in the water vapor above you. So it's a very good test to look up at the sky. If there's forecast of some Northern Light, look up at the sky and see, can you see a lot of stars, or can you only see the brightest stars? If you can only see the brightest stars, it's too much stray lights. Then you have to find the darker spot where you can also see the faint star, where the sky is actually black. Because in particular, when you're using a long exposure, it will enhance that scattered light in the atmosphere. But like I said, the tripod, long exposure time, it's smart to have a wide-angle lens because then you get more of the sky. And if you are a little bit sophisticated, you should get a lens which has a low F number, which brings in more light into the lens. You can shorten the exposure time. Lots of photographers also turn up the ISO value. You go into the setting, and the ISO is basically also how sensitive the detector will be. So you can typically turn that up to 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 on the modern camera today. Then you can also shorten down the exposure time again. And the shorter exposure time, the more structure you will get in the Northern Light, which usually moves quite a bit.
Of course, if you push the film, then you need to tell the developer that you pushed that and change your ISO. Otherwise,
that's true, but I don't think people are using film anymore, most people. So it's a digital camera. You push up the ISO, but if you push it up too high, you will get more noise in the pictures, but some of the cameras today, you can push it up to several thousand without having any extra noise.
Does film work better than a digital camera?
I never used film myself for photography because I started too late for that. But I think most photographers, they only use digital cameras because they are much more sensitive than film in many ways. And there's also a new camera on the market now, a Sony A7S, which is the most sensitive camera ever built, I think. And you can turn the ISO up to 450,000.
Wow.
And with this camera, you can actually, for the first time, film the Northern Light live instead of taking lots of still photos and putting them together like a time-lapse, which you can see on the video on YouTube all the time. So this camera is really amazing. And on our DVD, we have a bonus film after the documentary, a four-minute bonus film. And this bonus film has some really nice sequences taken with this new camera. For the first time, you can actually see how the Northern Light's moving in real time.
So it's a Sony A7S, right?
Yeah. It's fairly inexpensive compared to what previous cameras, that was really sensitive was before. I think in the U.S. it costs about $2,500 for the camera house. And that's not that much more than a very expensive Nikon camera, for instance. But it's just, it's so super sensitive. And you can also, you can film in 4K resolution. So you can actually make IMAX format almost darker with this camera. It's just an amazing camera. It got really good reviews, and it's on my wish list.
Harriet is in New York City, and Harriet says, I understand there are a lot of new scientific tools for studying the sun. What has been, over the last couple of decades, the most important scientific or technical advancement in being able to study and understand the sun? And could you list one thing that has come out of this research that tops all others as really the most valuable piece of information or new science that has come from studying the sun?
That was a difficult question. No, I think I will point out the SOHO spacecraft. SOHO was a satellite launched 20 years ago, actually, this year. It is the most complete solar mission ever built. It had 12 different instruments looking at different parts of the sun and the heliosphere. And it has some very interesting and important instrument on board. One thing that it we saw the sun was more dynamic. I mean, things changed faster than we thought before and so on. But I think the most important finding from SOHO and the last two decades is basically that we were able to see inside the sun. And we can actually see through the sun. We can see what's happening on the far side of the sun using a technique called helioseismology. And some of the viewers or listeners can probably have heard about the seismology, how we have basically made a model or picture of how the Earth looks inside. By using sound wave, how they propagate inside of the Earth, we can make basically pictures of the inside of the Earth. So we know the density and where are the different layers of the Earth. And we do the same thing with the sun. We can study sound waves that are moving inside the sun. The sun makes it its own sound wave because it's like a big blob of gas that kind of rings in some way. And these sound waves will not escape the sun. They will be reflected on the surface and go down into the sun again. They will be bent upward again because of increased density, and they will hit the surface again. So they're bouncing inside the sun. And by observing the surface, how the surface moving up and down due to those sound waves pushing on the underneath the surface of the sun, we can follow those sound waves. And the velocity of those sound waves are decided by the density and temperature of the gas they're moving with. So by studying those sound waves, we can make very detailed maps of the subsurface part of the sun, how the sunspot look underneath. We have made pictures of that now. What creates them and what maintains them? Another very interesting finding was that we can actually check what's happening on the far side of the sun using this technique. So we can see now sunspots developing before they rotate into the view, our view. And from all of this helioseismology, maybe the most important finding was that we can determine that the temperature of the sun actually was 15 million degrees about. And there was a question mark about this because for those who knows about neutrinos from the sun, we're only observing one-third of the amount of the neutrinos at the Earth. That should come from the sun if the temperature of the core of the sun was 15 million degrees. So some argued maybe the temperature of the sun is not that high since there's only so few neutrinos. So what happened with SOHO, we could determine the model is right, temperature is about 15 million degrees. So we play the ball over to the particle physics again and say, now you have to explain why we only see those one-third of the neutrinos. So it's something wrong with the neutrinos, how they may be changing identity on the way and so on. So it was a really important finding to actually determine once for all that the temperature of the sun is actually that hot.
I have an app for my iPhone that shows me real-time pictures of the sun through different filters and different imaging, which is pretty amazing. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not.
Yes, I have it too, I think.
Of course, most of what I'm looking at, I don't have any idea what I'm looking at. But I mean, when would we ever get pictures like this, you know, to look at? I mean, this is phenomenal. So are these coming from SOHO, or where do these pictures come from?
They used to come from SOHO, but I think now most of these apps are picking them up from SDO, Solar Dynamic Observatory, which actually had taken over that part of the SOHO mission. The SOHO mission is basically almost shut down. It's only two main instruments that's still running on SOHO. That's for space, weather, and climate research. It's the coronagraph that shows the solar storms coming towards us, the CMEs, and it's the a monitor that monitors how much energy comes from the sun, because it's very important to track that to understanding climate change. So all the other telescopes are basically shut down. So SDO took over that role to take those beautiful full disk images. And what you're looking at there is lots of images with different colors, and those colors can maybe look confusing. The colors are false put on there. The ultraviolet light doesn't have any colors. They are just there to, so scientists and other people can then know exactly what filter, what camera took that picture. So the orange picture is typically the corona, the chromosphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, and then you have this blue and brownish are the corona. So by using different filters, we can look at different layers of the solar atmosphere from the surface, which is the yellow pictures with sunspots, up to the corona. And it's kind of similar to what you do at the Earth when you're looking at the human body. You're using X-rays to look inside the body. You're using infrared to look at the heat sources and so on. So we're using different parts of the spectrum, too, to look at different layers of the solar atmosphere.
Listener, the app on the iPhone is called Sun Viewer. In case any of you are interested, and it was a free app, and it's pretty amazing pictures for those of you that are interested. So I bring that to your attention. In terms of NASA planetary science, you know, we're going out to all these different planets, and they're planning a Europa mission, and New Horizons is coming up pretty soon on Pluto, and you know, Dawn is over there at Ceres and all of that. What is the role of the sun in trying to understand all of this planetary research? I mean, I'm sure the sun plays a part in it all, but Pluto is really a long ways from the sun. So does the sun factor into something like a planetary mission to Europa or to Pluto or to, you know, the asteroid Dawn?
I don't think it's really mattered that much, because the sun is used as an energy source for missions that doesn't go too far out in the solar system. If you go out to like Saturn and Pluto, you don't have enough sunlight anymore, so you need to use a radioactive source to get power to the instrument. But some of the mission, of course, studying the effect of the planets from the sun or solar wind. So because you can see they have northern lights, you can see there's things changing in the atmosphere. And some of the planets doesn't have any magnetosphere, like Mars. So the sun affects, of course, everything on Mars too. The solar wind particles are not stopped by any magnetosphere, so it will bombard the surface. And that can, of course, change the soil and things like this. Plus, it will be really difficult for humans to stay on Mars without protection. You need to either dig yourself down in a bunker, or you need some capsule with really thick walls to be able to be on Mars, since there's no protection from solar storms and cosmic rays, for instance. So the sun is a factor for some of the missions, and they also have to withstand, of course, solar storms and so on.
For something like Pluto, does it get much energy from the sun at all? I mean, that is so far out there.
It's almost nothing, I think. It's on the border of almost like the solar system, and the temperatures there are always very, very low, so it's not much energy that comes out there. And again, it just shows the same thing when we're having a probe out there, that even if solar panels are there, it's really hard to get energy. But the Rosetta mission, still using solar panels for when chasing that comet. So if you build them big enough, you will get some energy. If you don't, but again, if you go too far out, it's not
Can't
useful to have solar panels again.
Bijan has yet another question for you. What type of science investment in observatories or spaceflight missions would you like to see in your research? If you were designing the research, what would your priorities be for solar research?
I think it's to try to understand the physical mechanism that creating the dynamics on the sun. A good example is the IRIS mission that was launched 2 years ago. And Norway is also participating in that mission, and we're also taking all the data down at Svalbard, which is the most important bounding station. But that has so high resolution that we may be able to understand some of the processes that are initiating solar storms, because today we cannot warn about solar storms very good. We see it when it happens. When the lightning strikes, of course, it's too late for some. So what we want to try to do is to be able to say that this sunspot region will explode in 10, 15 hours or something like this. We cannot do that today. So today we are monitoring these sunspot regions and the complexity of the magnetic field. And NOAA, Space Environmental Center, they send out a warning every day that today it's a 25% or 50% chance that next 24 hours there may be this strong storm. But that's not really good enough. We want to try to be much more precise and like I said, but then we need to know more about the processes that's initiating those solar storms.
So what do you have to do to get research for that type of thing? What kind of instruments are we talking about? Is it another satellite that does it, or can it be done from Earth?
I think we need both ground-based and space-based. The advantage for ground-based observatories is that you can build it much bigger. The mirror can be huge, and you get high resolution. But you are limited a little bit by the Earth's atmosphere, which we can now correct quite good with using, active optics and so on.
Right.
But you also have clouds, and you have day and night. So it's not 24 hours observation. But combining that with space-based, we need to see the different layers of the atmosphere, and we need spectrometers to determine the velocities and so on in the sun's atmosphere. And we also need magnetometers that can measure the structure of the magnetic field, because the magnetic field is basically what drives the whole thing of the sun. So today we have, I think we have a good tool already with the STO, which has a very good magnetometer, but we need also the new spectrometers that look at the details of the plasma around these regions. And we need to study the sun over a longer time to have better statistics for solar storms.
Are there lesser known visible effects from the sun than the northern lights that we probably don't know about, but we should know about or maybe can see?
I think it's the northern light is just a manifestation that there's a connection between the sun and the earth. And when there's strong northern lights, it's also more space weather effects on our systems. And sometimes there are some high energy particles that also reach in ground, called ground level events. Again, they're not dangerous for humans, but they can affect some electronics and maybe manufacturing of computer parts. It's a fairly minor problem, but in principle, we know about most of the effects that the sun has on our society, I think.
But in terms of something really dramatic and visible, the northern lights are it. Is that correct?
I think, yeah, that's certainly the most visible part and the most beautiful part, too. And it's also interesting now that lots of companies and people making lots of money on this beautiful view.
Is any good northern latitude good for seeing them, or are some countries better situated if you really wanted to max out for the best view possible? Where would you go?
Yeah, it's certainly, I mean, it sounds probably strange and stupid when I say the best place to go to Norway, but there are good reasons for that, actually. The northern light is formed in this oval that circles around the magnetic pole. And that oval, where you can see the northern light every single night, will touch the tip of Norway. It's basically between Norway and Svalbard. It goes over the northern tip of Iceland, the southern part of Greenland, and then the northernmost part of Canada and Alaska, and then Siberia. If you're looking at that map, And if you're looking at temperature or number of people living in that band, you'll see that where you have most people living is actually Norway. And that's also where you have big cities and airports and universities in that zone. But if you go to the northern part of Canada in the same latitude, there's basically nothing there. It's tiny villages. If you want to go up there, you have to charter flights. It's no daily flights. It's much harder to get up to the really northern light zone in some of these countries. Alaska is probably the easiest for people in the U.S. because they're going to go to Fairbanks and so on. But it's also colder in these regions, in northern part of Canada and Alaska. It's typically 20, 30 degrees colder than it is in Norway. So it's more pleasant to be a tourist in Norway, too, when it comes to that. So, and it's same as, for instance, also Sweden and Finland in many ways. But the northern Scandinavia is the best place and the easiest access to the Northern Lights. Even if it's kind of far to travel for people in the U.S. to get there, it's the infrastructure is there in much more than it is in northern Canada and northern Alaska.
What is the best season to go?
The best season is typically September to April. You have to be dark. So in the summer, of course, the nights are too bright and you won't see it. If you look at the statistics, there's typically more northern lights September, October, and March, April, close to the equinox. But in principle, when the sun is acting like it is now, it's the whole season it's usually very good. And typically in Scandinavia, the best northern light is usually around 8 to 2 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock in the afternoon or evening. In the U.S., typically a little bit later. They shifted a little bit. It's due to the orientation of the Earth and the magnetic field and so on.
Pretty fascinating. If one wanted to do this, I guess that they could just Google Northern Lights Tourism in Norway and find listings of companies that do this, correct?
Yeah, there's lots of companies. And one of the most popular cities to go to, Tromsø. It's a big city up in North Norway. It has like 10 flights from Oslo every day. They have lots of companies there. In addition, you have this cruise line that goes along the coastline of Norway, which is also focusing a lot on the Northern Lights tourism. It's called Hurtigruten. It's 10 ships going up and down the coastline all the way. So every day the ship stops at the one harbor to deliver goods and people and so on. And they have they turn off all the lights on the ships and they call you out of bed at night if there's Northern Lights out there. So it's a very nice way and popular way of exploring the Northern Lights far away from all the city lights.
Listeners, again, his DVD, which I will put the URL into the archives of this show, is available at solarmax.no/aurora/dvd.html. And I think you'll be suitably impressed. Any takeaways or concluding comments or pearls of wisdom or what we should remember about our discussion today or about the sun or northern lights?
I think to learn more about northern lights, we'll also learn more about how the sun and the earth is connected. And it's a very nice historical story behind this and the first pioneering scientist that did this. So it's an extremely nice story, I think. And also that we can actually see this connection. When there's something happened on the sun, a few days later, we will get strong northern lights overhead. So we, like I said, we try to do this in our DVD and try to explain all these things. And we got so much interest from this DVD too, so we or this the film before we made DVD, so we decided to make it into a multi-language DVD. It's 8 different languages, including Spanish and Chinese, Japanese, German, French, and so on. So it's so most people should find a language they can turn on and understanding this thing. And it's also quite nice to use it for teachers in education because it's in many countries the Northern Lights is actually part of the curriculum.
And you just found out today that you have a film festival award for this again, right?
Yes, I won 5 awards 2 weeks ago in the film festival in Portugal, and today I got another email from another film festival in Warsaw, Poland, that we also have one of the main prizes there. So I'll have to go there too, I guess.
And it's titled The Northern Lights, A Magic Experience. You have a late email that came in. I think you can maybe answer it really quick. And this is from Barbara in Houston, Texas. And Barbara says, I'm always reading articles or hearing people say that the sun will die out in X billions of years. How do you calculate the remaining life of the sun?
Well, first of all, I can tell her that the film will actually probably play in the IMAX theater in Houston in November this year.
Oh, okay.
That will be fun. How long the sun will last will basically depend on how much fuel is left, how much hydrogen is left in the core. And that's calculated based on stellar models. We've been studying many other stars, and we know the temperature structure, and we know how old the sun is and how much fuel it's using every second. Every second, it's about 700 million tons of hydrogen is converted to helium. It sounds like a lot, but the sun is really huge, so it will take another four or five billion years before it's over. So it's fairly standard stellar models that used, and we are fairly certain that these numbers are correct.
700 million tons per second?
Yes. And of those 700 million tons, 4 million tons of mass is converted into energy or light, gamma rays and neutrinos. So actually the sun gets 4 million tons lighter every second.
I mean, that's not even conceivable. very, very amazing and impressive. Doctor, I want to thank you for taking time out on your busy trip here in the United States to talk to us again on the Space Show, and congratulations on the success of your DVD, and I will stay in touch and look forward to talking to you again down the road.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it. Come back on Sunday. Chris Stone is with us. National Security Space is the topic on Sunday. Everybody have a great weekend. It is Memorial Day here in the States. So pay attention to why we have Memorial Day and honor our troops and those that have made supreme sacrifices, and come back on Sunday. Thank you, everybody, and thanks to Dr. Brekka. Have a great weekend. Goodbye from the Space Show.